The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Talking about today, in fact this week, has to do with the future and the present world. When I say future, I mean the next 10, 20 years. I would like to talk about the world that the church is facing. I'm not going to be talking a great deal yet about how the world should be responding to it. How the church should be responding to it, because in a sense, that's something that you're going to be hopefully considering as you go along in the course. I'll say a few things, especially on Friday. But what I want to do is try to set up for you some ideas. What I want to talk about is several trends, very important trends. Those of you who are not from this country, you're going to find that some of the things I say are going to be more global, but I'm going to say a lot of things about how the global changes are impacting on our country right now. And we have to be constantly asking ourselves, what kind of church should we be? How should the church be responding to this? I sincerely believe what Harvey Kahn says in his book, Eternal Word and Changing Worlds, and that is that hermeneutics is not a straight line, but a spiral. And that is, you learn from a text mainly what you ask it, you see. What we understand the text to say doesn't just depend on using the proper kinds of grammatical historical exegesis, but also we come with certain questions. The Bible has all kinds of answers, but we only hear the questions that we're asking it. And there is no doubt in my mind that as the world changes, we're going to be confronted, in a sense, by the world, to see things that the church should be, that though God always intended for the church to be like that, and though God said in the Bible he wanted the church to be like that, we didn't realize it until we confronted it. I mean, you see that with the apostles. The earliest apostles just kept going to the Jews. And as you can see in Acts 13 and a few other places, Acts 8, God actually had to come down and punch the apostles in the mouth and say, I want you to go to the Gentiles. Now, if you read the Gospels, you'll see Jesus was always talking about that. So what's going on here? Why is it that the apostles didn't see it? Because they were myopic? Because they were doing their own exegesis on their Savior's words, and they just didn't have a grid by which they could see what Jesus was saying? And it wasn't until certain situations came up, you know, until the Spirit broke out in Samaria and the apostles said, what happened? How'd that happen? And they ran on down to look and see what was going on. The situation that was happening in the world forced them to see something that the church was supposed to be, that Jesus Christ intended the church to be, but they didn't know it until that situation happened. So a lot of these situations are going to press us into seeing more of the richness of the biblical ecclesiology. Do you see what I mean? And here's what I mean by the trends. Let's talk about these. I'm going to talk about the explosion of the third world. Okay? Explosion of the third world, and we'll talk about what the implications of that are. Okay? Political instability and fragmentation. Fragmentation, okay? I don't know how many I'm going to get through today, but the aging of America, and actually of developing countries in general. Most of what I'm saying about America will fit developed countries, not developing countries, excuse me. And by the way, developing is, some people consider it a pejorative term, and I can sort of see why. Western nations, European nations, America, most of what I'm going to say about America is true of the West, and not so true of third world. So when I talk about the aging of the population in America, that's not true of third world countries, but it certainly is true of the so-called developed nations or the highly industrialized nations. Let's see if I can get this far today. I don't know. I've got 13 to handle for you. So secularization of America and pluralization of life worlds. Let's see. Let's see how far we get. Let's see. What I mean by the explosion of the third world, what I mean by that is, at the very least, these two are interrelated. It means that in the third world, you've got massive explosion of population, but you've also got so much political instability and fragmentation that you've got unparalleled kinds of movements of people. You've got more people than ever, and you've got them moving, you see. You've got millions of people moving from one country to another country because of a disaster, because of a political situation. You've got people looking for stability in their lives, and as a result, at least the way it impacts on a place like America, here's some of the impacts. Number one, you've got the ethnicizing of America. What I mean by that, for example, and this is a little bit difficult, when I use statistics, I want you to know I'm doing it with a lot of humility. I'll tell you why. Not because I'm not a statistician. That might be part of it. If you do this for a living, you're always sure your statistics are right. But the more I study this, the more I see general trends, but so much divergence. Somewhere between the year 2000 and the year 2050, the number of people who are Anglos, the so-called white Americans, have become a minority in the country. I just don't know when exactly. It's difficult to say. There is the statement that in the 1980 census, the number of people who checked the box white American was a minority. That's true. The point is, though, we're not sure exactly why that happened, because the number of people who are white Americans, that means not black, not Hispanic, not Asian, all right, is still a majority. It could be a lot of people still, because their parents were German, they don't mark down white American. We're not completely sure about that. But we do know, for example, within 10 years, around the year 2000, in this country, there'll be 40 million black Americans, 35 million Hispanics. I know, where you get these are general statistics. 10 million Asians, about 10 million Muslims, which is about 100 million people. So at least 40%, by the year 2000, 40% of the country will not be Anglo-Americans. And then, depending on whether what you read, you know, USA Today says one thing and everybody says something else, somewhere that group will become the majority of the country. And it won't be that far off. I just can't tell you when exactly. Somewhere, certainly within 10 years, a third to a half of the population will be comprised just by those four people groups, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and Muslims. Now, if you want a real good rule of thumb, if you can't remember everything else, just realize that the Hispanic population in this country is growing twice the black population, and the black population is growing at twice the Anglo population. That's for sure. And if you can't remember anything else, you can remember that, right? That easy to remember? Okay. And what does that mean? It surely means at least major cultural changes in the country. It's got to. All right. That's what we talk about, the ethnicizing of America. We talk about it because it's a reality. Another part of the explosion of the third world is urbanization of the world. And you stick around Westminster long enough, I'm not the guy to talk to you about the statistics on this, but you know, of course, Harvey Kahn and Manny Ortiz are the people that talk to you about this. Maybe you haven't run into a class where someone talks to you about this, so I'll tell you a few things. In 1950, just New York City and London had more than 10 million people. Those are the two biggest. By the year 2000, there'll be 25 cities with over 10 million, and only two of them will be Western. Probably New York and, anybody know probably the other one? I mean, in the top 25, only two of the top 25, the biggest 25 cities in the world in the year 2000 will be Western. New York will be one, and the other one will be Paris. Probably Paris. I mean, we're not sure, see. I read all these books, and everybody's a little bit different. But in general, Paris. Not London, no. No, London is, I'm afraid London has really been knocked out of the pennant race. I don't know why, but they're not growing anything like that. By the year 2000, more than 50% of the world will be living in large cities, which means cities of more than a million people, something. But depends on, again, who's giving the statistics. And no matter what, that's major change, right? Huge stuff. Here's something very important, and it goes along with this. Migrations of the disenfranchised. One of the urban mission, which is the Westminster, one of the Westminster one of the two Westminster periodicals. One is the journal, Theological Journal, and the other one is Urban Mission. I think it's two or maybe three issues ago, there was an article by Viv Grigg in it, and I don't even remember the name. Does anybody here remember the name of the article? I think it was Oops, the Frontier Moved, something like that. It was a cute title, that's why I can't remember it too well. But the main point he makes in there is that these large urban centers that are growing so fast are mainly growing because poor people are flooding into them. And that the most mobile people in the world are the poor. So, for example, in the 23 largest cities in the third world right now, an average 45 to 50% of the populations live in slum and squatter communities. The majority of the new residents, that's just about a half of the residents, but the majority of the new residents, the vast majority of the new residents, are poor people. These are people that have come in either as refugees, or they just come in from the mountains, or they've come from the hills, or different places looking for something better. And most of you would recognize at some level, the church growth people have said years ago, that humanly speaking, people are more receptive to the gospel when they've gone through changes. That's the reason why every pastor that knows anything about trying to help his church grow realizes that you go after new residents. A person that's just moved into town, you knock on the door, and the chances of them coming to your church or even being open to the gospel are always better, humanly speaking, than someone who's lived there for 40 years. Why? Because when there's one upheaval in your life, you become more open to lots of things. So we've always known that, generally. This means, according to Viv Grigg, that the most receptive people, the most important people to be seeking to evangelize in the world today are the poor. And one thing you do have to keep in mind, and that is, I think it's a simple fact of history, that revivals have always started among the little guys. And never, never, never has a great revival started because a denomination, an agency of a denomination decided, let's have a revival. Let's have a program. Let's get our churches to double by the year this and that and this and that. You never see revivals as being things that leaders, the people at the top, have ever, ever started. In fact, 9 times out of 10, the people at the top oppose it for at least 10 years till somebody says, maybe that's good. And therefore, revivals have always started amongst the disenfranchised. They've always tended to start amongst the little guys. It's a very interesting point, but anyway, one of the implications of this trend, the explosion of the third world, there's so much upheaval, everything from natural disasters to political unrest and that sort of thing. It just means the world is awash in uprooted poor people. And that's another one of the trends. Unfortunately, there's a fourth one here, and I didn't leave room. Sorry. And this is very important as a result. And Manny Ortiz was talking about this in convocation last week. And that is the shift in Christian gravity, Christian center of gravity, to the south of the border. In 1975, 25% of the population of the world was in the so-called developed or Western countries. All right, that includes the Soviet Union. All right, Soviet Union, Europe, Canada, North America, well, not North America, Canada, United States, that sort of thing. 25%. By the year 2000, the population of that group will be 16% of the world. That is an amazing shrinkage. You're only talking about 25 years there. And when at the year 2000, when it hits 16%, it's still on its way down. There's no way has it bottomed out. In 1900, the Northern Hemisphere accounted for 83% of world Christians. Who says? Who counted their noses? I don't know. But generally speaking, in the year 1900, 83% of the world Christians lived in the Northern Hemisphere. Today, and this is where the debate is, just about 50% of the Christians live in the Southern Hemisphere and 50% in the North. Now, when we've crossed over that border, that mythical border, when we say now most of the Christians live in the South, most of the Christians live in the Third World, most of the Christians are poorer people. Most of the Christians are non-Anglos. Now, where have we crossed over that? No one's going to know that day. But the thing is very clear is if we haven't reached the day, we're on the way to the day, and that's the way it gets. That's the trend. For example, we really don't know how many Christians are in China. You know, at least every time I read a report, it's different. Some of you probably have a lot better sources than I do. But, you know, it's very, very likely there's 50 million Christians in China easily. And if 50 million, you know, that's got to be 50 times more than the Christians than there were there when all the missionaries were expelled 35 years ago. I'm not making a case for expelling all missionaries from everywhere. But, you know, it shows you what's going on. And what you say is, well, we're not getting into this now, but you're certainly going to come up against it again and again in the course. There is no doubt about it that a Christianity rooted in Chinese humanity is going to look different than a Christianity rooted in Greek humanity and a Christianity rooted in Hispanic humanity. And the Christianity rooted in Greek and then in Western European humanity has really pretty much dominated the world for a long time, but it can't for much longer. And that's why we put down here there's a shift in Christian center of gravity to the south. And these are I'm not saying this is good, bad. You see, quite frankly, this is what is happening. And in response to these things, I think, like the apostles, we're going to see all sorts of richness in our ecclesiology we never saw before. Now, I'll take time for questions before I move on to the second. You've got to realize I got 13 to cover in two days. I guess it'll be all right. Yeah, Brad. Of the whole population of the world was in the United States, Canada, Europe, and the Soviet Union in 75. It'll be, the year 2000 will be about 16% and on its way down. Okay. Yeah.
In light of that,
well, not just the PCA. You must realize that that's the whole point of that article. That was one of the most important articles I've read last year. Virtually all American missionaries go and live amongst, we call them the middle class. Now, you see, in other words, missionaries say, I don't want to live as a rich person. They just want to live pretty much the way a person in a blue-collar neighborhood here, say like where I live, Roslyn, which, you know, there's small homes and little clip yards, and the people are blue-collar folks, all right? And most of the missionaries do not feel that they're doing anything ostentatious or extravagant at all to say, I just basically want to live like that. Just give me a little apartment somewhere, a little place, you know, where things are kind of neat. And what that means is they live with the rich in the other countries. Now, here's the case. All missionaries do that, and they have to go around, they have to raise 50. Now, see, we're already getting into ecclesiological implications here. How do things change if this is all this is happening? Most missionaries, don't you have to raise $40,000 or $50,000 support? Now, Viv Griggs says, not if you went and lived in the squatter communities. You could probably raise your support $8,000 a year or less to live there. They don't tell you that, do they, when they're running around? But on the other hand, here's the question. There's a lot of missionaries that go overseas, and they still come back with a tail between their legs. They can't take the changes. They can't take the culture differences. They can't take, or the missionary can, but the wife can't, or the wife can, but the missionary can't. And as it is, it's very, very difficult to make the switch anyway. And so the answer, a good answer, is that these people, nobody could survive that. Very few Americans could survive that. And so it's not a PCA problem, but it is. It's sort of a general evangelical problem, and very few people are coming to grips with it. But anyway, that's in that chapter. One other thing he says in that article is then you have another problem, and that is that poor folks very often don't have they're good at one-on-one, but they're not very good at managerial stuff. They don't really know. It's very difficult to raise up poor Christians who then are able to lead a large group, you see. And that's the reason why what Viv Grigg calls for is people who will incarnate, that is, they'll go, they'll live among the poor, and they will not try to do it all themselves, but sort of be kind of a general behind the scenes in which they use their managerial ability to empower people, for example, train lay evangelists and give them the support that they need to go out and do all the, you know, plant churches everywhere. It's a very interesting article. I'm sorry, now that I've focused on it for 5 minutes, which is a long time in this course to focus on one thing, that I don't have it. But I'm almost sure it was, oops, the frontier moved or something like that. Or what happened to the frontier, something like that. Questions? I see another hand there. Cities, right. Yeah, that's true. It's also, I'll tell you, it's also, Well, the problem is that you can go, well, almost everything I do is for mixed motives. Why am I patient with a person who's just not coming around spiritually? Partly because I hope the Lord has made me patient because I realize how he's treated me, and partly because I don't like to displease people, and I don't want to confront him, and I'm a coward. And they're both operating. And what it means is that I continue to be patient with a guy. If I can discern that about 51% of my motivation is okay, which is as good as it ever gets, then I'll stay patient with him. And if it's 49%, I realize I'm being a coward. The same thing here. The motivation to go to the influential people is mixed. And we have to therefore do... I'll tell you, the only way out is to go to both. You see, the only way out is to go to both. Right, right. Yeah.
So the fact is that we got to evangelize all of
yeah. That's fine with me, yeah. Yeah. This is right. And, yeah, absolutely. That's very helpful. Implications, let me just say this and then we go on. The implications are vast. For example, some are trying to say, I don't think we're going to get it through in most places, that we should stop talking about home and foreign missions anymore, and we ought to talk about cross-cultural and domestic. For example, in this country, I'm finding as part of a home missions committee of the PCA, we're realizing that we probably need to pull somebody from our Lisbon team to Bedford, you know, for New Bedford, Massachusetts, and Fall River, where about 100,000 to 200,000 Portuguese live within a mile, within an hour radius, and have somebody there who's working on reaching Portuguese people, because there's this pipeline back and forth. Harvey says there's whole villages in Mexico that you can find. Half the village 5 years ago is now in two or three neighborhoods in North Philadelphia. And if you're trying to reach the village, you ought to have somebody in that block in North Philadelphia and somebody in the village. And instead of talking about home and foreign, we really do need to talk about domestic. In fact, Harvey doesn't like to talk about world missions anymore. He talks about global missions. Just trying to show that we can't use the same old distinctions. I do know this. The largest, most growing groups in the world are not the groups that American evangelicals have ever really been able to win very well. They're poor people, they're third world people, they're urban people. Okay. All righty. Now, political instability. This, I can be a little bit more brief about this in some ways. Two things here. A rise in totalitarianism. I don't believe that you can say that communism is taking over the world and that democracy is losing out. But one thing you can say is totalitarianism is taking over the world and democracy is losing out. Okay. Sorry about my handwriting here. What I mean by that is, worldwide you see a growing trend toward totalitarianism of both the left and the right. That in order to keep order, more and more governments, ostensibly, is what they're saying, more and more governments are going after absolute power, and they're saying it's the only way to do it. There's almost something to it. Maybe, have anyone noticed that in 1960-something, there was a blackout in New York City? It was in the summer, and about 10 years later, in the 70s, the very same thing happened. If I remember correctly, it was about the same amount of time. It was in the same city, only 10 years later, and it was even the same time of year. It was hot and all that sort of thing. The first time, there was an awful lot of pulling together, I understand. There was an awful lot of, there was very little looting, and very few people took that much advantage of things, and people were helping one another out. But it was very different in the 70s. There was a lot of looting. There was a lot of disorder. Under the cover of darkness, everybody says, now I can get my slice. And I understand, I remember reading a Time essay, the back of Time magazine, saying, what does this bode? It's the same city. This is the same same time of year. It's only been 10 years or so. Why so much more disorder? Now, everybody's got different reasons for that, and I've got some, too. I can't get into them now, but the fact is, because of that fragmentation and disorder, there's been a rise in totalitarianism. I just think it's a little bit simplistic to say the communists are taking over the world, but it is probably right to say the dictators are taking over the world. And it's in the United States. You can even see this fragmentation here, the so-called bastion of order. You know, look at it this way: there's taxpayer revolts. There are huge increases in consumer boycotts. There are special interest lobbying. There's incredible number of state initiatives and referenda. And the fact is, that we do not have the old identifiable kinds of political leaders we used to have. We do not have the kinds of people with clout that we used to have. And American people, I put this down, American people are really not any more liberal Democrats or conservative Republicans. There is a tremendous lack of consensus about which way the government should go. There is a tremendous dearth of leadership. It's almost impossible to get things done at any level. It used to be, it was rather easy in some ways to get an interstate highway built. And now it's impossible, just about. Because everybody has the ability now to keep it out of their backyard. And maybe that's okay in some ways. I mean, when I do diaconal conferences, somebody says, "We don't know any poor people in this country. Where are the poor people?" I say, "Get on the interstate highway and look down, and they're under you," because they were the people that couldn't keep it out of their neighborhood. You know, they're either in the city or way out in the country. Where, people with clout could always keep an interstate highway away. So you just get on the interstate highway and look down. But that's not even true anymore. The fact is, just about everybody is able to keep an interstate highway out of their backyard. And there's a tremendous amount of fragmentation. And the second thing, as I said, leadership vacuum. This is true in all sorts of areas. There's a leadership vacuum, not just in the political realm, really, but in the educational realm, in the art realm. Somebody could sit down and even in the theological realm. You know, 20 years ago, you had names in almost every realm, and now you don't. You see, big wigs, big leaders, except for rock musicians. They have to have them, you see. Even if they're no good anymore, even if the Beatles were a whole lot better than Bon Jovi, we've still got to have these people because people will buy their records. So there's certain areas where we have to manufacture big names, but in areas where you don't, in the areas of art and literature, in the areas of politics and government and education, okay, we don't have them. We don't have the leaders. Let me talk a little bit more about the aging process here. A couple of things that you might find interesting, except that first of all, I've got to find it. The age trends. This is a little bit easier to project than other areas. This isn't just true of America, as I said. This is true of the Western and developed countries. A couple of ideas. The elderly population, in 1904, 4% of the population was over 65. Okay? 1900, 4% of the population. Today, 12% of the population is. And by the early 1990s, things are going to grow to the place where it could be as high as 20 to 25%, but that's a little bit difficult. I do know that between 2010 and 2030, when my generation, that's a lot of you guys too out there, when we turn 65, there's going to be big trouble because we will be between 20 and 25% of the country is going to be over 65. Some of you know that when Social Security was begun, there was 13 wage earners paying money into Social Security for every one recipient. Today, it's 4 wage earners for every one recipient. And somewhere around in that 2010 to 2030 time frame, it's going to get down to 1.1 or 1.2 wage earners for every recipient, which means it will fail. I mean, there's almost no doubt about that, one way or the other. There are certain areas of the country that are graying faster than others. Florida is graying faster, and the Midwest is graying faster, and New England is graying faster. That's not that germane to you all right here. That's something that we have to take a lot of account of anyway. Okay, I don't think I have to go much further. Before I do, though, questions on what I've been covering right here? Political instability, aging of America, very, very important to understand that. What is that going to mean? Yes, Ron? In other words, there's more and more followers and a lack of leaders. Well, you mean people don't want to follow anyone? Is that what you mean? Okay, let me tell you, this is a very good question. And as far as I know, there's probably no difference. It's still a trend. He says, how do you really distinguish between a leadership vacuum and a submission vacuum? In other words, maybe it's not that there's no leaders, but because we hate authority and because everyone wants to do what's right in their own eyes, that we simply won't acknowledge leadership. And I know, as far as I know, I would say the two are working together. The fact is, there's fewer people who are willing to follow people, and I can't be completely sure that those aren't two different trends. They're the same thing. Yeah, Jim? Right. Well, if you put this together with a lot of the other things, when you look at all the trends together, it's a relatively new development in church history that the American church has done, especially evangelicals, have done very, very little in the area of diaconal service and work with the needy and the poor and the elderly and disabled and the sick. In other words, that was always a major part of the church's work. Word and deed together always went together up until about, 50, 80 years ago, somewhere in there. And since American evangelicals have, their concept of the church is really a place where we study and talk. If you're really honest, you'll realize that if you look at the so-called activities of your church, we talk about activities, there's no activity going on, it's just talking. You have a conference, there's no activity, you're just talking. When you have a class, it's not an activity, you're just talking. And almost 98% of what we do in our evangelical church is talk instead of doing things. There's word ministry, that's evangelism and counseling and preaching and studying. And there's deed ministry, that's healing and giving and fixing and changing bedpans. And that's deed ministry. And Americans are really in for a rude awakening if they think they can keep that up. When you put that all together, that's, I would say, the aging is one of those things. But there's going to be others, too. I don't know we can get into all that. Maybe on Friday, sure, we can go back and look at the implications of all of that. So, one of the things, surely, is that Americans have to realize the government is not going to be able to take care of the old people the next 50 years the way they have for the last 50 years, and the church hasn't had to think about it at all. It used to be, as far as I know, one of the very first groups that the church took on as their... they took on their needs completely was the widows, and I'm sure in many cases widows were older women. And so almost from the beginning, Christians knew that it was their job, the church's job, to care for older women. And American evangelicals haven't done that for years. They haven't needed to. Yes. Yeah, the New Deal's part of the culprit. Well, look, and the Great Depression came along, and you had 25 to 30% unemployment. I mean, everybody had to pitch in, and the private agencies and the church was all overwhelmed, and so to a certain extent, something had to be done. But then what ended up happening was when it's almost like the government said, we're going to step in here and do something too. But when when things got better, everybody but the government said, thank goodness the Great Depression is over. And basically, yeah, I mean, it's not just their fault. It's our fault too. That's right. Aging. Now, secularization and pluralization, I'm going to talk to you about it, and we'll have to start with this next time. These trends are all rather different. They're all trends, but now we're talking about a worldview thing. And I'm trying to think the best way to put it, to get it across. Let me, if you've read Ozgeness's book, The Gravedigger File, it's a hard book to read. Because he's trying to write like the Screwtape Letters, backwards. So the person writing it is giving diabolical advice and so on. And as a result, a lot of people just don't get it when you read it. But basically, in there, he is saying that there are two marks of the modern mind and the modern worldview. And that modern mind, again, this is the Western worldview more, okay, than the third world. That is secularization and pluralization. Secularization is the understanding that religion has to be and only can be something for the private life. That religion has nothing to say. Religion is good for you, but it has nothing to say to the public sectors. Now, the public sectors is Guinness, or Guinness. He's like Augustine and Augustine. I've never been able to figure out how to say either of those guys. Ozgeness and St. Augustine. The public sectors are science and technology, politics, corporate business, education, and the major media. And we are, in a secular society, we're told religion has no place there because it doesn't have any absolute value, it doesn't have any objective value. And the modern mind sees the injection of personal beliefs into the marketplace as non-professional. This is one of the reasons why there's so many ways in which secularization has influenced you and me. The old demonic approach was to make a person a secularist. Secularism is not the same thing as secularization. Secularism is a formal worldview. I don't believe in God, or if he's there, I don't believe in a supernatural, I don't believe in life after death, you know, that's a secularist. Secularization is a social process by which a person can be radically secularized, even though if you ask him his creed, he gives you the Westminster Confession. All right? But he's secularized in, for example, there's so many ways in which secularization is carried, like a disease, like germs. It's carried into your veins all sorts of ways. It's not by sitting down and having someone argue out of the Christian religion. Instead, it comes through Dear Abby, it comes through your college professors, it's come through the concept of professional. What does it mean to be non-professional? Harvey Kahn has challenged me that the modern concept of professionalism is inimical to the Christian understanding of what it means to be a minister. He doesn't even like me talking about Christian ministers as being professionals, because the idea of a professional is someone who is one way on the job and doesn't inject any personal beliefs, and off the job can do anything. You watch Hill Street Blues, you watch St. Elsewhere, you'll see that one of the cardinal teachings there is it doesn't matter what you do in your private life. You see, you can be publicly a terrific person, even though in your private life you're an absolute slob, you're a cad, you're selfish, you see. You can live any old way, but publicly you get professional. You don't inject your personal feelings, everything is fine. They just see the two realms as being completely different. And all right? Be secularized means religion is totally privatized. In a lot of ways, it's subjectivized. And Oz Guinness quotes this NBC executive who, after he became a Christian, was born again. Someone asked him, "Is that going to affect your programming?" He says, "No. Oh, no." He says, "My religion brings me peace and joy and happiness in my life, and it gives me more clear thinking, and it gives me refreshment. And if anything, it's going to make me a better programmer, but it won't affect the way I do programming." Scott? Oh, you see it everywhere, absolutely everywhere. It doesn't matter if he lives like that. It's his private life. Who cares, you see? Right. Now, I mean... Okay. Yeah, yeah. Now, look, these two are together, and let me give a statement of it just so you have it between now and Wednesday. These two go together because we believe in this bifurcation. So religion is only in the private realm. Everything's in the private realm. That is, that the modern worldview says it's in the private life of leisure and relationships where you find meaning. The old approach was you worked, you see. That's where you found your meaning and purpose. You, put it this way, you lived in order to work. You took time off and you refreshed yourself in order to work. But the modern mindset is you work in order to live. You work, you take whatever job is necessary, you do as good a job as possible so you have the money to really enjoy yourself and find yourself, to go skiing where you want to go skiing, to have the home you want to have, you see. That's where you live in the private world. So there's this, we call it the pluralization, means the fragmentation of life worlds. It used to be that there was one overarching set of values that bound everybody's world together. Your public life, your work life, your church life, your life as a citizen, your life as a father, your life as a mother, your life in the family, your life with friends, was overarched by one set of values. Not now. Radically different sets of values in each area. That's the reason why you have midlife crises. That's the reason why you have the abortion. The people do not say they're pro-abortion. They say they're pro-what? Pro-choice. Why? Because, you see, the way in which you find meaning is not through any external role that you maintain, but you as an individual should have and must have, to find meaning in life, the right to choose any one of these different options. You get meaning by being free to choose to be anything you want. Any sexual preference, any gender, you see, to be able to choose anything you want to do with your body. That's the way you find meaning. You don't find meaning in your roles, you don't find meaning in the public life, you find it only in the private life. And your only identity there is you're a person who has the right to choose. Now, that was too fast to really give you a good understanding of it. But if you want to understand the culture, you've got to get these two down. And if we're going to be able to preach the word into the culture, we've got to get these two down. We're going to start with that next week.